Bonjour. Hi, good morning and good afternoon. Buenas tardes. Nous sommes ici réunis pour la conférence de Arturo Escobar. And j'ai le grand plaisir, avec toute l'équipe SOGIP, d'accueillir Arturo Escobar cet après-midi à l'EHESS. Tú no entiendes lo que estoy diciendo, pero he preparado una traducción ahí para los que están allí al frente y tienes la traducción en español y en inglés. Voilà, muchas gracias. Donc, c'est un grand plaisir que d'accueillir Arturo Escobar et je le remercie très chaleureusement d'avoir accepté de donner la conférence d'ouverture du workshop international que SOGIP organise sur le thème des peuples autochtones et leurs droits à la terre, politique foncière, patrimonialisation, industrie extractive. Alors, Arturo Escobar est un passeur de sens, a cultural broker, transmitter of meaning, un passeur de sentidos, de conocimientos, qui s'est frotté très jeune à la différence. Un sujet qu'il évoquera dans une minute à propos du territoire comme espace de vie et de culture. Doté de la double nationalité, pardon pour le suivi des... voilà. Donc, interprété de la realidad, pasador, transmisor de conocimientos, se acercó muy joven a la diferencia... Il tiene la doble nacionalidad, colombiana et estadounidense, et il a étudié la chimie en Colombie, les questions alimentaires au plan international, à Cornell, aux États-Unis, et pour conclure finalement avec un doctorat à Berkeley en philosophie du développement, planification et politique. Venu à l'anthropologie sur la base d'une réflexion post-structuraliste, non. Non, llegado a l'anthropologie, etc. Arriving at anthropology, please read. Venu à l'anthropologie sur la base d'une réflexion post-structuraliste et post-coloniale, vous êtes rapproché des études subalternes et vous participez du réseau des anthropologies mondiales. World Anthropologies Network. Arturo Escobar est le Keenan Distinguished Professor à l'Université de Caroline du Nord, à Chapel Hill, et donc Keenan Distinguished Professor of Anthropology. Vos thématiques actuelles, dont la conférence nous donnera un bel aperçu, relèvent de l'écologie politique. Et ce domaine vous a amené à inclure des questions de développement et des mouvements sociaux que vous abordez essentiellement à partir de l'Amérique latine. Mais ces propositions théoriques font écho au-delà de ce continent et de cette discipline, possiblement parce que l'Amérique latine peut être vue comme un laboratoire des transformations du monde. Et vous contemplez aujourd'hui la possibilité d'une ère dite de post-développement, dont l'intitulé même implique la critique de ce que développement veut dire, qui le définit et comment. Alors, l'un de vos premiers travaux très remarqués, publié en 1995, Encountering Development, the Making and Making of the Third World, vous a conduit à reprendre les outils analytiques de Foucault, de Michel Foucault, notamment l'analyse de discours, pour dresser une généalogie du concept de tiers-monde qui vous a ramené vers l'administration américaine et la consolidation politique de son hégémonie. À partir des mouvements sociaux, et nous verrons dans cette conférence un cas précis défini ou dessiné par les luttes des peuples afro-descendants de la côte pacifique de Colombie, vous montrez combien la critique du développement conduit à un affaiblissement du sujet lui-même, remis en question par toutes sortes de formations discursives. Mais ce qui se joue là-bas va au-delà des discours. Les luttes et les critiques des peuples indigènes autochtones s'expriment sur la scène onusienne, elles circulent sous forme de publications, elles martèlent des idées que l'on voit reprises par des organisations comme l'UNESCO ou la Banque interaméricaine de développement. Je pense en particulier au concept de développement avec identité ou développement avec culture et identité. Development with identity or cultural development with identity. Et cela nous interroge précisément sur ce que cette ère de post-développement introduit et comment vous la sentez. Alors, en 2008, vous publiez Territories of Difference, Place, Movement, Life's Redis, qui nous conduit directement au sujet de cette conférence, Territories of Difference et l'ontologie politique des droits à la terre. J'en parlerai donc pas plus longuement. Je voudrais simplement signaler ici que Arturo Escobar est un auteur très prolixe qui nous a fourni un texte d'une quarantaine de pages écrit très serré en espagnol et que vous êtes aussi un auteur multilingue qui avait produit un PowerPoint en anglais et qui prononcera sa conférence en anglais. Et now I would like to invite Arturo to take the chair and to pronounce the conference. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Bonjour, or bonsoir, whatever you say at this time of the day. Thanks everybody for coming, for being here. I want to start by thanking particularly Irene Bellier for her invitation first to this event, which is very close to the kinds of issues that not only myself, but a lot of people have been working on in Latin America, in the Latin American context. I also want to thank Irene for her wonderful idea of doing this montage for the PowerPoint in three different languages. You will see how it came out. I think it works very, very well. It might take me from time to time a bit to coordinate between the two of us which slide is which, but I think we'll manage to do it quite well. I'd like to thank as well Yves-Marie Dovinet from SOGIP as well for his invitation and for his kind arrangements for us to be here. And all of the SOGIP team, obviously, and all of you for coming. I think that the theme with which the project deals is one of the crucial themes in today's world, at least the development world, as we know, the development world, or globalization world, but also in many ways in the field of life itself. And that's part of the argument that I want to make, that we're not talking just about indigenous people and about land or territory. We're talking about the conditions for life itself on Earth in times of global social and ecological crisis. Okay, so I apologize also. I wish I could do the presentation in French. I hope you can follow well in English. I do have an accent in English. I will try to speak slowly. If I speed up, I tend to speed up, just tell me to slow down or just raise your hand and ask me to repeat, okay? So, clear so far? Are we on the same page? Wonderful. Okay. Okay, so first, let's begin with a word about the title. Territories of Difference, the political ontology of rights to land or rights to territory. And there are three key terms. I'm going to talk for about 50 minutes, if that's okay with you. I might not be able to go through all of the slides. So we'll start with the reflection of the title itself. Territories of Difference, the political ontology of rights to territory. So there are three concepts there. The concept of territory, obviously, the concept of difference, and the concept of ontology. And if we bring these three concepts together, this is the argument that I'm going to make, we will arrive at the somewhat different notion of politics that we're going to call ontological politics. By that I mean a politics in which explicitly what is at stake is the defense of life, but not only the defense of life, but the conditions for seeing the very perception of what life is about, what counts as life, okay? And that's sort of the ontology bit. And we'll see why, go back to this funny word in philosophy, ontology, that, you know, is so old, you know, goes back to the Greeks. And especially we're interested in developing a non-Eurocentric approach to many of these things, then why go back to ontology? So at some point in the second half of the presentation, we'll be able to see why use ontology and not use, for instance, culture. Culture is very important, it's a very important concept, but it is not sufficient, I think, or we think, because I'm doing this work with a group of people, a group of friends, it is not sufficient to convey the wide range of categories, meanings, and struggles that are going on today, at least in Latin America. I should also clarify that my presentation is going to be mostly based on Latin American cases and debates, and even more so on Afro-descendant debates, although I think they will apply in many ways to both indigenous issues and also to indigenous peoples in different parts of the world. Okay, so a little bit about the talk. So start with a little bit in a very intuitive way. I mean, what is the connection between self-determination, which is one of the main topics for today's, for the conference itself, and ontology? And again, ontological politics. The basic connection is going to be that self-determination or autonomy, as many movements in Latin America call it, is in many ways, it's about land, it's about the economy, it's about politics, but it's not only about that. It's also about the conditions for life, the definition itself of knowledge and life. Then we move on to talk a little bit about the territory in Latin America. And I followed the argument of a really interesting Brazilian geographer, Carlos Walter Porto Gonçalves, who argues that the concept of territory starts to appear in South America, and to some extent in southern Mexico as well, in the late 1980s, with great mobilizations of indigenous peoples out of the lowlands, the tropical lowlands of America, into the highlands, and carrying with them many indigenous constituencies. And you remember, especially in Ecuador and Bolivia, southern Colombia, Chiapas, obviously with the Zapatista, late 80s, early 90s, is a period of really amazing effervescence in indigenous mobilizations. And so we'll see the implications of that. So it wasn't academics that started to say about, oh, nah, let's talk about territory instead of land. To some extent, there was a connection with academics, and academics caught up. But in many ways, says Carlos Walter, it was a challenge posed by indigenous peoples and indigenous movements themselves. Okay. Then we'll talk a little bit about one particular case, which is the case with a group of activists, Afro-Colombian activists, with whom I have been working for many, many years, for 20 years now, who have developed a very sophisticated conception of the relationship between territory, culture, identity, rights, autonomy, and conservation. We call that the political ecology of this particular movement, which is called the Process of Black Communities, Proceso de Comunidades Negras, or PCN, which is a group of, I mean, I feel privileged to have been working with this group for 20 years, because it's a group of really bright, super bright, and super committed activists. And then we shift the register towards the ontological level. So we'll reinterpret the defense of territory by the black movement, the way in which they conceive of it, into an ontological, into a political ontology of the territory. So we'll see whether the activists are defending, in defending territory and culture, are really defending their own vision of the world and the right to have it, inhabit a different world. Okay? And then we move into arguing with one of the colleagues with whom I work now, Argentinian anthropologist Mario Blaser, to talk about environmental conflicts. We all know, and a good part of the conference for the next 3 days is going to be about environmental conflicts, especially around mining and extractivist industries. And we're going to see that many of those conflicts can also be defined as ontological conflicts. And we're going to see what is the difference in making that distinction. Okay. And finally, some conclusions in transitions towards what we're going to be calling the pluriverse. Okay. So to start in a more intuitive way, Why ontology? So when indigenous peoples mobilize, almost every summit of indigenous peoples, peasants, Via Campesina, Afro-descendants in Latin America today, includes a declaration that the crisis, the contemporary ecological social crisis, is a crisis de modelo civilizatorio, is a crisis of civilizational model. What do they mean by that? I mean, if we really want to understand what they mean by that, then we're going to argue we shift into that model of that concept of category of ontology, and we're going to see there is a crisis in a particular set of ontological assumptions about the world, which you usually associate with modernity, with a dominant idea of modernity. There are many ideas of modernity, there are many types of modernity, but with a particular view of modernity. Okay? So when they use concepts like cosmovisión, crisis de modelo civilizatorio, change of epoch, paradigmatic change, epistemic decolonization, which is a language that many activists use today in Latin America, a decolonization of knowledge, communal, going back to communal forms of politics, all of these are ways in which activists state in somehow an ontological awareness, consciousness. And all of these are, can be seen as challenges to liberal, secular, and capitalist modernity. And I will say just about that. I mean, it's not just about capitalism. It's also about liberalism. It's about secularism. And what are the connections between these things? They are not the same thing. But let me say, as a general statement, that when we speak from the academy, most times, if we're writing from the academy about development or about all these different things, we speak somewhere from that space defined by capitalism, secularism, and liberalism. It's very hard to get out of that frame of mind because it's so pervasive and so naturalized. So we'll see how, in many ways, these movements are speaking from space that is partially different. It's not completely different, it's partially different. Okay. And then another statement of ontological politics is, I really like this sentence from Boaventura de Sousa Santos. That the contemporary situation can be defined as one in which we're facing modern problems for which there are not sufficient modern solutions. He actually says, for which there are no modern solutions. I meant that by saying, for which there are not sufficient modern solutions, because I think modernity itself, modern science, technology, has to be part of the solution somehow, and eventually will be. I mean, there is no way it will be able to not be. Okay. And then there is other things that I want to explain. If you look what's going on in the academy, in geography, in anthropology, in political philosophy, in cultural studies, there seems to be an ontological turn, and this is the concept that a number of geographers and anthropologists are using today, going back to concerns about fundamental assumptions about the world, not just about capitalism and so forth, but something more basic. Okay? So my argument is going to be the following. This is the most abstract, the most theoretical slide that we'll see, we'll have today. Okay? So bear with me. I'll just say it quickly, and then we'll try to explain it. So everybody knows, I mean, and all of you, I'm sure, who has been working with indigenous issues in Latin America know that, you know, from the 70s on, there has been this amazing emergence of indigenous voices, indigenous knowledge, indigenous movements, indigenous identities, cultures, all of these different things. Okay, so how do we understand that? And the argument that a number of people are making is that we can understand that, to really understand their importance, we have to see it at the intersection of two processes. On the one hand, the crisis of the neoliberal model of development of the last 30 years, from the 70s on, which clearly is in crisis, and we don't have the time here to talk about what is neoliberalism and how it is in crisis, but most of us know what it is about, neoliberal globalization. But the second process is the crisis of the more than 500-year-long project of bringing about modernity in the continent, in Latin America, which is also in crisis. And that indigenous peoples and black peoples in particular, in many ways peasants as well, are beginning to point at that second level of crisis, which is a centuries-old level of crisis. And there is where we find the importance of this conjuncture. For instance, let me go back to the next one, because I can't find it here. So, for instance, when one of the indigenous leaders in Ecuador say, nuestra lucha es epistémica y política, our struggle is epistemic and political, he's pointing out at that conjuncture, it is not just about economic equality, it's not just about political inclusion, it's also about the conditions of knowledge and the conditions of life. When Felix Pazzi, an Aymara intellectual from Bolivia, says, the social movement in Bolivia are about the total transformation of liberal society. I mean, what does he mean by that? It's a very strong statement. It's super strong. Because liberalism, the liberal society, is the society. You know, the society based on the individual, on rights, private property, democracy, representative democracy, all these different things. So Patsy, an Aymara intellectual in Bolivia, says we are challenging all of that. And we want a different system. So we'll see what that means. Okay. Next one, please. I have to follow here. Okay, so now we are at the argument. As I was saying, the most abstract slide. So, you know, some of you familiar with Foucault's work will remember maybe the notion, Foucault's notion of problematization. And Foucault meant by problematization the process by which a particular set of behaviors or situations become a problem. For instance, certain behaviors of the mind, or sexuality or delinquency. And that problematization of those behaviors create the opportunity for a huge development of domains, spheres of life, practices, actions, state interventions, all these different things. And that's what he called, you know, in a way, that's what he called a discourse. So in the same way, I'm trying to adapt that notion and saying, well, we have two fundamental processes, the process of problematization of identities. Again, in the 80s and 90s, in Colombia very clearly in the 90s, indigenous peoples and black people said, no, we don't recognize ourselves in your national project of a single mestizo Colombian nation. So it's a problematization of the national identities, naturalized since the time of independence in the 19th century. And the second process is that goes along well with a much fundamental problematization, which is the problematization of life itself. That life, because of global climate change, because of the destruction of biodiversity, because of all the environmental destruction and devastation that we're causing in the world with the model of accumulation and modernity and so forth, life itself is under threat, and that has become a problem. So how do different groups of people, different experts like the UN, sustainable development is a solution to the problematization of life. It's one that is very partial, as we know, especially after Rio+20. But how these movements are saying also, yeah, we have a response to the problematization of life. Via Campesina says very clearly, you know, our model of agriculture is a much better solution to global climate change and to the crisis of food and poverty than your model of industrial agriculture. So that's what we're talking about. Well, okay. So many ontological struggles, many ethno-territorial struggles can be seen as ontological struggles, as struggles for the defense of life itself. And this is the key concept that I'm going to explain for the most part the rest of the lecture. They interrupt the globalizing project of constructing one world, capitalist, liberal, secular, and of fitting many worlds into one. Okay? So the project, the dominant project of globalization is that of, at the ontological level, of creating one single world with one single set of rules. Of course, there's a lot of heterogeneity and diversity and contestations and many modernities within that. But at some level, at least, is the creation of a one world, you know, if you wish, we can say for the corporations and capital and rich countries, etc. And fitting many worlds into one. The most counterintuitive, the most intuitive example of what that means is the Zapatista slogan, a world where many worlds fit. Un mundo en el que quepan muchos mundos. A world when many worlds fit. And that's a theory we're going to say later on, a theory of the pluriverse, but it's precisely the project of challenging than one world metaphysics and one world ontology of neoliberal globalization. And then we'll say that these struggles are important contributions for ecological and cultural transitions, towards a world where many worlds fit, and as such, they are at the avant-garde of the search for alternative models of life, development, society, and economy. So that indigenous movements, indigenous struggles are not remnants from the past, they are not trying to stay in the past. It's the opposite. They are looking at the future. It is us moderns who are stuck in the past, who are stuck with the ideas of progress and markets and the economy and the individual, which clearly don't work anymore, which clearly are the ones that are, in a way, creating, you know, cooking us up, you know, through global climate change, cooking up the planet. Okay. And then I'll illustrate this with the case of Afro-Colombian struggles. Okay, let's begin with ontology. So, what is this business of ontology? And what is this business of indigenous peoples having a somewhat different ontology, culture, let's say? And I'd like to start with this photograph. The first time, this is from the Colombian Pacific. I'm going to tell you about the Colombian Pacific. The first time I saw this photograph, it really struck me because it's beautiful. It's a rainforest region. It's a father teaching a daughter how to use this local canoe on the river, which is going to be super important for her later on in life because many things take place through the river. But if we look deeply, I mean, if all of us try to do an exercise of the imagination, transport yourselves to this scene in a tropical rainforest, which is a place like any other place. It's just like Paris, but a very different ecosystem, of course. But people are doing, you know, carrying on with life. And trying to see with the eyes or interrelations what is going on. And what we see is something that is much more complex. What we see is two people engaged in an entire relation with an ecosystem, with the mangroves, with the canoe, which the father made out of a tree, local tree from the local forest, with the traditional knowledge that had about doing these canoes. We have the aquatic life that the locals know very well. We have the shellfish, we have the fish, we have the rhizomes, we have obviously the mangroves, we have the estuaries through which the people navigate very well and that is very rich in aquatic and marine life. We have the world of the divine, of the supernatural. We have the infra world, and there are many anthropologists who have studied what's this in all of its complexity. So for anthropologists, know what I'm talking about. We have an entirely different world. But so the argument I want to make to start thinking and unpacking our notion of the individual is that there is no father here, and there is no daughter, there is no canoe as discrete entities. There is an entire relational fabric, and is this relational fabric that is enacted and created in every single moment through every single practice in a world such as this. Okay? Same idea in a very different level. When the Zapatista rose January 1st, 1994, it's going to be 20 years, next January 1st, amazing. They say something similar. When they say, ya basta, enough is enough. What they meant is, we don't see ourselves in your world, we don't want to be included in your world as you define it. We want the right to define our own world. We have been here after 500 years of resistance, after 500 years of politics of genocide, we're still here, we haven't gone away. What different? We want our autonomy, we want our world. And our right to define our world in communication, interaction with many worlds, a world where many worlds fit, but not on this one set of rules that the Mexican state and transnational capital wanted to impose. Okay? Next. This is very interesting, too. This is from the same region in the Colombian Pacific. This is a group of woman shell collectors. It's very hard work. But it's a world, again. It's a world of rhizomes and mud and shellfish and the little shells that they collect. And one that they don't want to give up. They don't want to see destroyed to construct huge artificial shrimp cultivation schemes. It's one that they want to improve their conditions of living. They definitely want to improve the conditions of living. They want to have, for instance, rubber boots to be able to get into the mud. But it's not that they want to give this up and move to the city, because they know that that's a dead end. There's very clear stories about these movements of the women shell collectors in some parts of Latin America. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit about what are these relational walls. And they are defined by these very simple concepts that are very deep at the same time. The most important one is that nothing pre-exists the relations that constitute it. Okay, you and you and you and you and you and our friend, our baby that is going to leave, unfortunately. And they, we don't exist as discrete entities. We exist, we don't pre-exist ourselves as pre-constituted entities. We exist because we are related. We're here because somehow there's a fabric of relationship that brought us here. And the fabric of relationship is at many levels, with the water, with the sea, with the ocean, with the nutrients, with the microbes in our gut. All of us are a profoundly relational fabric. Nothing exists, pre-exists the relations that constitute it. Okay? We think we are individuals, we exist separate from the rest. Bullshit. I mean, nonsense. Okay. And so another way to say it is the person is embedded in the community, the economy is embedded in the society is embedded in nature, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we call that, with a group of people, the political activation of relational ontologies, or relationality. So that is what is rising up with the Zapatista. What has been enacted in the rivers of the Pacific is that relationality. And so the concept of territory, to start with territory. As I was saying before, Porto Gonçalves in Brazil suggests, and I think this many people agree today about that, there's a large mobilization in the 80s and early 90s that put the concept of territory on the table, on the agenda. For states and for international organizations, it resignified key issues such as land, conservation, and development. We're going to see one of those resignifications by the Black Movement in Colombia. One concrete manifestation of all of this in Colombia was what is called, in Colombia there was a new constitution in 1991. I'm simplifying a lot, but that's basically the essence of it. And then as a result of that, there was a particular law called Ley 70, Law 70, which granted collective rights, collective cultural rights and territorial rights to the black communities of many parts of Colombia, not only the Pacific, other parts of Colombia as well. But I won't talk about that, I will talk mostly about the Pacific. Okay? And there started the collective land, the collective titling process. A very interesting process throughout the 90s, continues today, against all odds, but continues today, is being pushed by movements in interaction with the state. Okay. And the case of La Toma, let me see, do we have time to see? Yeah, I think we have time to see. Let's see if we can see this. So this is a community in the northern, south of the city of Cali, north of Cauca region. It's one of the oldest Afro-descendant territories in Latin America. It has documented the permanence in this territory since the early 17th century, and it's been facing increased pressures for displacement because there's gold in the territory.
Y ya quedamos nosotros también en este trabajadero.
Mi mamá trabaja en la minería, yo estoy trabajando. Espero que mis hijos también, así sucesivamente, que sea de generación en generación.
Tenemos claro que estamos enfrentando a unos monstruos, como son las empresas transnacionales, que estamos enfrentando al poder, como es el Estado.
Así por así no van a venir de atacarnos de aquí.
Nosotros no podemos permitir eso.
Yo sé que nadie está dispuesto a salir de su territorio. A mí me matan acá, pero yo no me voy.
La primera amenaza llegó vía FARC.
Estamos durmiendo cuando llegó un muchacho aquí y tocó la puerta.
Pero también me da miedo que con todas las amenazas que han habido, alguien muera en mi comunidad.
¿Qué hacer de pronto de mis sobrinos, de mis hijos? ¿Dónde van a ir a parar?
Aquí la gente tiene que prepararse. Entonces mañana lo que toca es que decirle a la gente que se vaya preparando de una vez para defender la comunidad, porque en cualquier momento esto lo van a hacer.
So, a mí me matan, pero de mi territorio no me voy. I'm willing to die, but I'm not leaving my territory.
Donc ils vont me tuer, mais je ne vais pas quitter le territoire.
Mm-hmm. Merci. And this is... So, de mi territorio no me voy. What does it mean, de mi territorio no me voy? And this is actually, they don't have, this is one of the communities that don't have yet the title, the collective title to the land. They are in the process of trying to get it against all odds again. And they've been pushed, displaced, threatened. They leave, they come back. It's a community that has lived mostly on traditional mining, gold mining, for, you know, since colonial times, actually. Okay, so next part, we're going to talk a little bit about Colombia and about this particular social movement of black communities in Colombia and about the political ecology framework of this community that I mentioned in the introduction. So for the next 10 minutes, we're going to shift just fully to Colombia, and then we'll retake the more theoretical register going back to the question of political ontology. Okay, so Colombia. Few people know that Colombia has a very large black population. The official census says 12%. The unofficial census by movements, about 25%. In the 1980s in particular, there was this very interesting process of beginning to claim title to the territories. But it was a collective sense of territory. It wasn't individual land. The 90s was a decade of mobilization for the protection of the biodiversity of the region. In the late 80s, early 90s, this region was discovered to be one of the hotspots of biodiversity. It's a very large, really amazing tropical forest ecosystem. And in that context, there was a tremendous set of activities by the state, by the movements, by NGOs, converging to try to imagine what is this territory, how we can do something in this territory that doesn't spell out the destruction, but that actually leads to conservation of biodiversity and a different notion of development. In that context, this movement developed a very sophisticated notion of, as I was saying before, territory, culture, and so forth. Okay, 2000s arrived, and it was a complete change of scene. The armed conflict in Colombia spilled over into the Pacific, so the left-wing guerrillas, the FARC, the coca cultivation started to shift into the Pacific. It's a very clear case of policies of fumigation in the eastern lowlands of Colombia, shifting the coca over the Andes into the Pacific and going up the rivers, displacing communities by force, the FARC getting in, the paramilitaries getting in, the army getting in, and it was just complete devastation and destruction. A little bit more about the Pacific. It's an area of about 10 million people, over 1 million inhabitants, 90% of them are Colombians. Again, high levels of biodiversity, and in that context, huge attempt by the government to do macro development projects, construction of ports, roads, all these different things, but also at the same time, conservation activities. So very schizophrenic set of policies during the 90s and today. Now we're going to show you a few images of some of the rivers in the Pacific. What you see in the forefront is coconut palm trees. So there's dispersed settlements. What you see now, some of you might recognize it, is that instead of that very dense rainforest, what you find is the monoculture of African oil palm. So this is a monoculture of African palm for the production of biofuels. Before the 1980s, there was no African palm in the Pacific. By the early 90s, there was already, in the little southern part of the Pacific where I worked before, over 30,000 hectares of African palm. Again, sort of people refer to both sugar cane and African palm as the green monster, you know, the local black inhabitants. And this is a really amazing picture. I don't know who did this little hut, but it's in somewhere in the river of the Pacific, I think the Tumaco region, because it was part of an international mission to document the expansion of African palm in the Pacific. And the way in which I see it, you see this little hut next to the river without any land left, because behind is the Green Monster, behind is the African palm plantation. So you say, what has been squeezed out there for me? And what has been squeezed out is an entire world. It's a way of being, it's a way of seeing life, it's a way of feeling, it's a perception, it's a way of categorizing the world, it's an ontology, as we're going to call it in a moment. Okay. And this is sort of like in the 2000s, a plague, a disease, hit the palm in the Tumaco area and devastated the plantations. Sort of, I call it sort of Gaia's revenge. So in a way, Gaia playing along the lines of the local people, destroying the African palm. But for the most part, the plantations have been rebuilt, unfortunately. Okay, so we're talking now about the political ecology of the PCN. I'm just going to call it PCN, Process of Black Communities, which is this particular group of many organizations into this network of organizations. We're going to discuss the five organizational principles, basic principles of the movement. These principles and this political ecology framework, again, has not developed in the heads of activists, but in the engagement between activists and the state and the NGOs and transnational companies and academics and all these different things. Some of the key notions that I'm going to highlight are the notion of how do they conceptualize territory, and we're going to see how interesting it is, and region territory and the question of autonomy. And finally, we're going to see talk a little bit about biodiversity as well. Okay. So we're going to go quickly, very quickly over this because of time's sake. But we have the principle, the movement recognized in 1993, five principles. The first principle is the right to an identity or the right to being black, and which is the right of having their own cultural vision. So it's a declaration about identity, about being, about fundamental way of being. The second principle is the right to the territory, the right to the territory as the space for being, for exercising the identity, and the territory as the basis for having their own cultural vision of development. The third right is the right to autonomy, so to a right to a certain measure of social and political autonomy. Again, all of this in connection to having our own vision of what to do, our own vision of the future. And the last principle is the derecho a una perspectiva propia del futuro, the right to our own vision of the future, especially the construction of an autonomous vision of the future. So it's not just about the past. I mean, although they do talk about the past and about traditions and the ancestral traditions and all these different things, but it's a very future-oriented movement at the same time. And that's what we find, obviously, with most indigenous movements. It is our misreading to suggest that indigenous movements are just about the defense of the past, because they've never been that. Okay? So to contribute to the implementation of a different model of life. Okay. Now, so the concepts. First concept is the concept of territory. And the concept of territory is the territory is the space for the effective appropriation of the ecosystem by the local communities. So the local communities live on these particular ecosystems, so how they relate to the ecosystem, that's what it is called the territory. So it's a particular conception, it's not just the land. There are many dimensions of territory, as we're going to be seeing in a moment. And the figure one is that figure that sort of summarizes this. It is centered on the life project. Proyecto de Vida is the life project of the communities. And what sustains the life project of the communities is the territory. And the goal of that life project is the buen vivir, the collective well-being, the good living, a good way of living. Many of you might know already, how many of you have heard about this notion of buen vivir? Okay, wow, cool, that's great. Okay. And which is making a very interesting career in South America in particular, out of Ecuador and Bolivia. We'll talk a little bit about that later on if we have time. In Colombia, in the late 90s, some of these movements were already talking about the buen vivir, so it's a very interesting. And the second concept is the concept of region territory. So if they say, and then in the early 90s, mid-90s, indigenous groups and black groups started to get together in the Pacific and to say, well, what is this territory that we have shared for hundreds of years? And they decided, they came up with this concept that the Pacific, that the geographers define as the as a, in biological terms, as the Pacifico biogeographico, the biogeographical Pacific, is really also an ethnic territory of ethnic groups, a region territory of ethnic groups, and sorry, a region territory of ethnic groups. So it's a collective space where there are multi-ethnicities, but which these groups have been able to live on without destroying. Okay, and that's the second, which is the region territory is the political project of the movement. So the defense of the region territory is the political project of the social movements, indigenous movements, and black movements in the Pacific. And we'll see in the next one that all of these, this life project of the communities and political project of the social movements, buen vivir and territorio región, are connected through the concept of autonomy. That what allows this vision of territory and region territory to exist is the autonomy of the social movements over the territories and their lives and their decisions and their vision of the world, from the perspective of the vision of the world, and that's the last, much more complex picture. Okay. So those are some of the main concepts of territory. Let's see now, in the academic register, what are some of the debates on territory? And this is just a brief, very brief minimum idea about debates in geography and anthropology about territory that I know much more about the Anglo-Saxon and the Anglo-American and Latin American context. I am very ignorant, so I'm here to learn about how these issues of territory are discussed in France or in other parts of the world that I'm not familiar with. But one of the main things, obviously, first, is that territory is not the same as land. And that might be very Latin American, I don't know. In Latin America in the 60s, peasant struggles were struggles for the land, por la tierra, las luchas por la tierra para el que la trabaja. Ladies, 90s, struggles for territory. I'm going to see that this, we already see and know that there's a big difference there. Obviously, territory doesn't coincide with the nation state, which is the main usage. I mean, even in common usage, there is the French territory is the French nation state, or the Colombian territory is the Colombian nation state, et cetera, et cetera. So I like this idea. I guess the next one. Yeah. From Carlos Walter again. It says, he distinguishes between territorio, territorialidad, y territorialización. Territory, territoriality, territorialization. And he says that the territory is a dense category that presupposes the geographical space that is appropriated. So there is an act of appropriation of the territory, living in the territory, okay, constructing the territory. The territory doesn't exist by itself, it exists with humans and non-humans in it. So that's the territorialization, the appropriation of the territory. Second, that creates conditions for identity, for cultures, for worlds, for ontologies. That's territorialidad. The territorialidad. And the process of self-appropriation is what he called the territorialization. Okay? Another way of saying it is that the territory constitutes the new mode of geographying the earth. I don't know if that makes sense to you in French. Maybe it makes better sense in French. In Spanish or Portuguese would be geografiar. Grafiar is to the inscriptions on the territory that the humans and non-humans live on the territory when they live on a particular territory. The constitution of new territories and territorialities. Okay. So that the territory is not just biophysical, it's epistemic, it's cultural, it's ontological, it's all of those different things. Okay, and we're getting to the, finally, the ontological part, we're almost there. So when indigenous peoples claim and defend the territory, they are reinventing space for life from the position of difference. They are expressing their resistance to neoliberal deterritorialization by, by new by globalization, and they are engaging in a movement that Mexican ecologist Enrique Leff and Carlos Walter Porto Gonçalves call re-existence. So it's not just about resistance, it's about re-existence, about reimagining and transforming the conditions for existence. Okay, that's the ontological resistance as well, and so forth. Now, finally, the political ontology of the rights to territory. So we're going to try to make it more, complex, this idea that what is at stake in territorial struggles, and this is the crux of the argument that we're trying to make. Again, it's a collective argument with a lot of people that we're trying to make. It's not just about material conditions. It's not just about economic inclusion. It's not about political equality. It's not about none of those. It is about those as well, but not only about those. It's about what we're going to call ontologies or worlds. So to do that, I'm going to appeal to a definition of ontology, which is not sort of the standard definition in philosophy of ontology. In philosophy, usually ontology is the study of the conditions for being or existence, what it means for something to or someone or an event to take place or to exist. Now, we're going to see that ontology has three different levels. The first level is those assumptions that any social group considers to exist or takes to exist in the real world. The kinds of entities, the assumptions about the kinds of entities that any group believes that exist in the real world. So, for instance, we moderns, to begin with that topic, believe that there are individuals, there is table, there is case, there is all these different things as discrete entities. There is the economy, separate from the whole of social life. There is the individual, separate from community. There is all these clear entities that we have invented in the West. And those inventions have very particular genealogies in the cultural history of the West, okay? So that's the kinds of entities. The second level of ontology is that ontologies enact worlds. Are we in the same? Ontologies enact worlds. And the key question of ontological political ontology is the following. What kinds of worlds are enacted through what kinds of practices? So we go back to the Rio, to the river in the Pacific, with the father and the daughter. So there's a set of practices. There are many practices that are enacted in a particular world. We ask that question of ourselves here, ourselves in Paris. What is the practices, cultural practices, economic practices, spatial practices, practices of going on the metro that enact, continue to enact a particular world, okay? So that's the key question of ontological politics. It's a very simple question in many ways. But it's one that we can do a different kind of ethnography of practices when we see it in this way, okay? And what are the consequences of those enactments for what kinds of humans and non-humans, okay? This is a question that John Law in particular asks. Some of you might be familiar with John Law. John Law is one of the main authors in this field of science and technology studies, STS in English, Estudios Sociales de la Ciencia in America Latina. How would it be in French? I get the same as Social Studies of Science and Technology. Well, one of the gurus of this field is in France, Bruno Latour. But John Law has a very sort of different development from Latour, which I think is fascinating, especially his new work for thinking about ontological politics, especially John Law and Anne-Marie Moll, who is from Belgium. And they, working with science and technology in very high-tech fields of biological fields, medical fields, they say science also, through the daily practices, scientists in hospitals enact particular realities, particular reals, as they put it. So the struggle, ontological struggle, is for what kinds of reals are going to be enacted, by with what consequences in terms of power, destruction or not of the ecosystems, et cetera, et cetera. And the last level, and the last level, so we're talking about the three definitions of three layers of ontology. First, ontology is about assumptions of the kind, about the kinds of entities that are taken by a given group to exist. Second, they are enacted in practices. Third, they are also displayed in narratives such as myths of creation. And Irene was reminding me at lunchtime about some of the beautiful work of Levi Strauss about sort of deep myths that exists in, I mean, many Amerindian ontologies about how the world got to be created and organized. It's a completely different ontology. Okay. And then we're going to go to the next one, political ontology. So what is political ontology? A political ontology is a new field of study, okay? It's an emergent field. It might stick, it might not stick. You know, we'll see if I convince some of you that this is interesting for you to engage in. The category itself was introduced by Mario Blaser, but in a conversation with many people, indigenous movements in South America first, and also STS scholars, especially John Law and group. And political ontology studies two processes. First, the process of constitution of one world within itself. So that the world of the Pacific, again going back to the picture of the photograph of the river, that world, the constitution of that world, is studied by political ontology. Let's say anthropology does that too, up to a certain point. We're going to see the difference. But second, and maybe more importantly, the intersection, interaction among different worlds, which is oftentimes conflictive, not always. So political ontology is very much focused on the ontological conflicts that exist among worlds, okay? And the final thing that we're going to say is that obviously worlds are not completely separate. It's not that we have one world of ontology here, another here, another here, another here. They are not islands. They are completely overlapped, interwoven in relations, historical relations of power and knowledge and so forth. So that's a very important, through partial connections. What is interesting, what is super important to keep in mind is that in their interweaving, in their interactions, one world never defines the other ones completely. So there is a tendency that the modern world, when it expands, because it's so homogeneous, so hegemonic and overpowering, completely defines the other world. The best counterintuitive example of that, this is from two feminist geographers, Judy Graham and Catherine Gibson, who say that, for instance, in every society, every patriarchal society, which is every society, women are subordinated to men, but women are not defined by men. So worldwide, the modern world system, colonial world system, whatever you want to call it, neoliberal globalization, impacts and in many ways influences and shapes all of the other worlds, but doesn't define them completely. So what is it that escapes? It's been defined by the dominant world of neoliberal globalization, and that's the key question of ontological politics. Okay, that's the notion of partial connections. If we move to the next one, then again, to sort of recap, in an ontological relational ontology, nothing pre-exists, the relations that constitute it. There is a Buddhist, I always say that Buddhists have known this for 2,500 years. You know, this is one of the great insights of Buddhism, the profound relationality of all of life. I like this particular statement by Thich Nhat Hanh, a very revered Buddhist who actually lives in a village in France, that says the flower doesn't exist, the flower interexists. For the flower to exist, there has to be the water and the rain and the soil and the bee that pollinated the plant and all of these different things and the mycorrhizome in the soil and this, maybe the seasons and all these different things. So when we see flower, I mean, if we look at flower with the eyes of the relational ontology, we see all of that complexity, okay? So when we pick up the flower, we're sort of in a way picking up the complexity of the world that has created that flower. It's the theory of interbeing, as he calls it, very interesting. Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, two Chilean phenomenological biologists, speak about the unbroken coincidence of our being, our doing, and our knowing. Fascinating. The coincidence, he said, the unbroken coincidence is not that here we have mind separate from body and mind-body separate from world. It's that we have mind contiguous with body, contiguous with the world. And it's like if we could, you know, I assume people who used to do drugs, that's what they were into, no? See the interconnection with everything. And some people try to imagine themselves sometimes being sort of a tree, part of a tree. So you are sort of, we have roots in the universe. We have roots up as well, or roots or branches up as well. So that's what they are talking about. And Maturana and Varela have a fantastic different theory of what cognition is that we don't have the time to get into here, but it's important. Anthropologists have demonstrated ethnographically for many, many decades that in many communities worldwide, there isn't the separation between nature and culture, between humans and non-humans, as we know them at least. There isn't the separation between the biophysical world, the human world, and the supernatural world, but there is some sort of contiguity between these, so that the humans are part of the, and nature is part of the social world. You know, one of the great exponents of this, of course, is Philippe de Scola here in Paris. Tim Ingold, who is, in my mind, is sort of the great thinker of relationality in anthropology today, along with Marlene Sauthern in England as well. Eduardo Viveros de Castro, more recently, has also been doing some fascinating stories about this. And if we contrast these relational ontologies with sort of the modern ontologies, and I know gosh, time has gone by quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, 10 more minutes?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
I think you have to finish.
Okay. I got to finish, but they might start throwing tomatoes before if it's if it gets too long. Okay, I'll finish in 10 minutes, promise. We're almost at the end. So we contrast this with the modernist ontologies, our ontology, okay? Again, you can say that this is an ideal type, archetype, so to speak. And many of you will react and say, oh, that's not the way it is. And in many ways, it's not the way it is, but in many ways, it is the way it is. That our ontology is based on these dualisms. I mean, philosophers have studied this for a long time. And one of the great origin, the one who opened the Pandora's box, is our friend René Descartes, with the invention of the famous dualism between mind and body. But then a whole series of dualisms that follow that between nature and culture, between us and them. Latour has a particular rendition of this in his book, We Have Never Been Modern, okay? That modernity is founded on this separation, the two great divides between nature and culture and between us and them. And there are many others, of course, between nature and culture, humans and non-humans. What is interesting, what John Law adds, is that it creates a single reality of a one world. This dualism sort of is the basis of this idea that we are individuals, mind, body, and world is separate from us. It's like the world goes around, like without us being really, all of us enacting that world along the way, okay? And that creates a whole series of key beliefs, the fundamental beliefs of modernity. Charles Taylor, Canadian philosopher, has a really little, very small, beautiful book about this, which is called Modern Social Imaginaries. He says the key categories, inventions of the modern West are the individual. We believe in this thing, the individual. Total nonsense from the perspective of a relational ontology, from the Buddhist perspective, from ecological perspective, even from a deep ecology perspective, that, you know, that doesn't exist. We believe in the economy, separate from the whole of social life. We believe in truth, one truth, and we believe in this real, separate from us. So those four beliefs is the ones that we are trying to make more visible and move away from. Now, why culture is not enough? And this is I found it a very neat demonstration. This is from Mario Blaser. So imagine we have the relational ontology of the Ishiro people of Paraguay, which is Mario's example, or maybe many of the groups in the Amazon that like Irene or other people have work with, or the black peoples of the Colombian Pacific. So we have the relational ontology. And we'll see what happens. Is it another culture, another representation of that single reality or not? And see what happens. And this is how ontologies or worlds get to be domesticated. They are reduced to being a manifestation of the same underlying ontology of the same underlying world, assuming that we have a single nature or single natural reality So culture one is the translation of the reality, culture two is a different translation, culture three, culture N. But what makes everything possible is modern ontology. It's we moderns who see what is going on because we have universal reason. This is from Tim Ingold. Tim Ingold say we have universal reason, we see everything. We have the moderns, we have the non-modern one, and modern two, and modern three, and modern, and we bring them all together, but what legitimizes all is this universal reason. So he says, literally, we have to descend from the abstract universe of universal reason to the stream of life if we really want to understand and connect with the stream of life and foster a living ecology, a different kind of ecology of sentient beings, which involves all humans and non-humans. Okay, now we move to the final part. From this perspective, and this is maybe a strong statement, neoliberal globalization is a war on relational walls. It's a war on anything collective. When we push and push and push and push the market and the creation of the individuals, and these indigenous peoples and black peoples, peasants, many land-based peoples in Europe, everywhere, feel it very strongly. It's a war on their relational walls. Okay? In the Pacific, there is all this amazing war on the Pacific now. There is mining concessions, there is agro-fuel plantations, there is coca, there is macro development projects, roads, all gold mining, all these different things. Massive displacement. Colombia has the largest internally displaced population in the world. 5 million people, internally displaced population. A disproportionate number of them Afro-descendant and indigenous. So when we talk about something like land grabbing, which is sort of internationally in the academy, we refer to this as land grabbing. Land grabbing is also, if we see it in terms of ontologies, the occupation and the evacuation of a population to destroy that world and put in the world of the plantation into being, or the world of the open pit mine, or the world of whatever it is, the world of the markets and the individuals, et cetera, et cetera. And in that sense, then, environmental conflicts are also ontological conflicts, are conflicts among worlds. We're going to skip this one, and maybe this one, because, you know, some of you work in the Andes, and especially in Bolivia. This is a demonstration, mostly, I guess, by indigenous peoples in Evo Morales. I think this was in May of last year. So what is here, again, is the Aymara enacting a more communal world. And I know the word community is very problematic for many of them. We can discuss it in the question and answer period. It's not the old-fashioned understanding of community. There's a new understanding of community as well. But what is interesting, there are two concepts from here that is interesting. Is the first one is that this is from some of the Aymara intellectuals and some academics as well who are saying, well, in Bolivia, we don't have simple social movements. What brought Evo Morales to power was entire societies in movement. So societies in movement and not social movements. It's not discrete social movements, it's worlds mobilizing and bringing up a different reality. And those worlds are being defined in non-liberal, in terms of non-liberal and non-state forms of power for the defense of territory, place, and so forth. Okay. So, some key questions of, I'm going to skip over this one and this one also. Some key questions, just two slides more, maybe two or three. Dilemmas of ontological politics. It's sort of the question where we see about what's happening in the Pacific, okay? And this amazing pace of destruction that is happening there, and the amazing courageous defense by activist movements. What we see then is how do they maintain the conditions for existence and re-existence in the face of this developmentalist, extractivist, and modernist onslaught? So that's sort of the key question of ontological politics. And obviously, this doesn't take place in isolation, so the multiple worlds and multiple reals become a crucial question as well. But without overlooking the issue of ontological difference, the theoretical question, articulated by John Law mostly, about how we might craft encounters across ontological difference. How do we, you know, as anthropologists, as the UN, as people who are interested as NGOs, how do we promote, work towards, contribute to the enactment of these encounters across worlds under the conditions of greater symmetry and greater equality and greater chance for all of the worlds to survive, not just one, but many worlds. So that we have to widen the political spectrum from the usual left or right to include the epistemic and the ontological as an ontological possibility, as a domain of the politics. And we are faced with two opposing projects. The first project is that of a view of globalization as the universalization of modernity. This is what, you know, you're sitting from the World Bank and the IMF or the European Union, all these different things. What you see is that the universalization of modernity, or this is an ideal project, markets and individuals and corporations all over the world, with security and order, obviously, for the elite, for the major, for the minority. That's one project. The other project is globality as the struggle to preserve and foster the pluriverse. So the struggle to preserve and foster the pluriverse, the world where many worlds fit. And so the change from the project of one world to a project of many worlds is the key step. And then we have another way of stating the same, is that if we look at what's happening in Latin America today, and we know that there are many left-leaning regimes, Chavez, Correa, Morales, Cristina Fernandez, et cetera, are they really doing something different at this level or not, at the ontological level? And the ontological level, we say, no, they are not. What they are doing is alternative modernizations. So in Latin America, there are the conventional, brutal neoliberal modernizations, like in Colombia and Mexico, okay? The most conventional and brutal of them all. We have kind of nicer, more decent globalizations, modernizations, like in the progressive regimes, which want to bring about a better living condition for most people, but is still within the conventional extractivist development model based on destruction of natural resources. Or we have, I think that, that one. Or we have transition projects as the second possibility, which is based on non-dominant practices, communal, non-liberal, non-state, relational, the ones that we try to highlight here, and forms of autonomous politics towards a multiplicity or what many intellectuals in Latin America today are calling post-liberal, post-capitalist configurations. So the question is, and the last one, which is I think the last one, is it possible to go beyond capital as the dominant form of economy, beyond Euro-modernity as the dominant cultural construction of socio-natural life, and beyond the state? And what do I mean by that? I mean, it's not that capitalism is going to disappear overnight. It's not that liberalism is going to disappear or the state. It's that the dominance in the definition of social life is going to be displaced, decentered, weakened somehow, so that other non-liberal, non-capitalist, non-state forms of seeing life and organizing into collectivities can also come into being and flourish. And the last part that I wanted to say is about that I didn't forget to mention. When I mentioned transitions, is the transitions then to a conception of globality in which there are many worlds possible, and there are many, I mean, if you start looking at people who are writing about transitions, ecological and cultural transitions today, and this is the other thing that I've been doing for the past, you know, 10 years or so, is collecting ideas, visions, imaginaries, narratives of transition, transition discourses. And what you realize is that many of these people who are really, many of them are really visionaries, who are talking that we need to move to a new ecological social model of life and to a very different kind of world. And that's a very important project, political project and cultural project. And in Latin America, it's taking the form, one of the main forms, is the transition to post-extractivism. And the transition to post-extractivism is that theory of transition and methodologies, because there are many methodologies of transition now already worked out And there are many groups involved in this transition to post-structivism. There is a framework, a very elegant framework, I can talk to you a little bit more about in the discussion for transition to post-structivism. Meaning by that, then, the transition to a social and economic model that is not based on the structivist development model, but on a model in which humans and non-humans can really finally find a way to coexist in mutual enhancing manners. Okay? And that's what, you know, we call the pluriverse. Thank you.